listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We got a very talented singer-songwriter and musician, and I say and musician because he actually is a real musician. Mr. Ryan Hiller, how are you?
How you doing, brother? Thank you so much, man.
Dude, I mean it. I mean every word, man. You know, it's like, it's not just enough to call you a singer-songwriter because you can play, man. You can slay.
Oh, thank you so much. This is, I'm honored to be on your show tonight.
Well, dude, this will be the first of many, all right?
So yes.
Get used to it.
So hell
you're on,
yeah.
You're on the East Coast right now, right?
I'm on the East Coast, yeah. It's a little late my time, but life is beautiful.
That's right. It is. It is indeed. What part are you? Are you in upstate New York? Where are you?
So we were in the city. My wife, her family's from Montauk, which is the end of Long Island, past the Hamptons.
That's
so
awesome.
Yep, I'll be here. And I've got a gig in Massachusetts leaving in 2 days.
Where are you playing in Massachusetts?
I'm playing in the, like, I don't even know the, like, the correct, it's Western Massachusetts in the hills. It's in a private, it's a private event. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
One of those gigs we do for to feed the family, you know.
I've done plenty of those. I know.
Yeah. Dude, but it was kind of fun because I got to redo all my gear, so it's been a while since I've flown with my whole rig. So I kind of downsized everything, and there's a few new pieces of gear that I bought that I think are I've never been more happy with my sound. Honestly,
let's talk about that first because I
love do it.
Yeah, let's tell me what's your gear setup.
So I'll tell you really the secret sauce is the new Strymon Iridium.
Oh, have I
you,
love
you
that
check
pedal.
This thing out.
I love that pedal, it's so dope.
Yeah,
so dope.
I just because I've been a Taylor guitar, you know, guy for so long with the T5, which is. For the guitar players out there, it's like a hybrid, you know, so it's half electric, half acoustic.
It looks like an acoustic electric guitar.
Yeah.
It actually plays like both, right?
It's got five pickup switches or five pickup settings, one pickup switch, but five pickup settings. So if you go all the way to the front, it's like a body sensor, kind of like what you'd have in a regular acoustic guitar, you know, that same technology.
Right.
But then then it's got a humbucker. And then it's got a pickup under the neck. So there's different configurations of those pickups that you can get different sounds on. But I treat it like an electric guitar. I put electric strings on it.
Whoa.
And the problem with it, and if you go on forums, you know, people say, oh, it's a little thin. So I put it through this, before I did the Iridium, I did, it's called the T-Rex Brown Sugar. You check that thing out.
I don't know that pedal. I don't know that pedal.
Okay. It's just – that's like my little secret.
Okay.
So I run it through there, and I turn it all the way off. But
what
it's
is
just
it?
A little
is
reverb.
It like a clean boost? Is it
– That's what it is.
Okay.
That's what it is. But it's more than that because it does alter the sound.
Okay.
But for me, in a good way, it gives it a little brown sugar.
I love it. I already love it. That should be my porn name, dude. So wait, so you go in, are you still going into the brown sugar or no?
Yeah, okay. That's still in there. But I use that kind of as a reverb pedal now. But the Strymon, the Iridium, I had my first gig here in Montauk. And it's basically modeled after three amps. The Fender, I think it's a Fender Twin and a Vox and a Marshall.
That's right.
Yeah, and I was just messing around with it on the gig, and I really couldn't believe how much more, like, you know, substance I got.
What I love is, like, you know, I used to love and I still love Fender Twins because there's so much headroom.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like I'm on the opposite scale. I'm like, I want things to break up. I want it to be brittle because I love that grit so much. So I do that with pedals. So
right. That's
the perfect pedal to do exactly that because you can get a little bit more oomph.
And yeah.
You find yourself blending between one amp or the other more, like one sound, or are you kind of like using all kind of sounds? Color?
So if I'm a guitar player on another, like as a guitar player, then yes, definitely. I would, you can save settings, you can save all your sounds. So you
That's
could
awesome.
Theoretically, you know, get all techie with it. But I'm a simpleton when it comes to that stuff. I'm the opposite of Edge, the Edge from U2. I need like two or three really good sounds, and that's what I, you know, a clean, a middle, and a dirty. You know what I mean?
And you do that. What do you do for your lead sound? Do you have like an overdrive, or do you just use your
volume? Yeah. So I've been experimenting with a ton of different ones. I really, up until now, I've been using the King of Tone Analog Man.
Yep.
You check that out? Yeah.
I love all of their pedals.
Yeah. Kenny Wayne Shepherd was using that, and I saw it. And I, on the T5, it does a weird thing. It almost gives you a clean boost on one side, and then the you know, the overdrive sound, and then you put them together, and it's just this creamy magic. But now I've got two other ones. The Wilmus, is that it?
I don't know that pedal.
Huh. Yeah, it's a new one. It's a new one that these are small. So another thing is I had to do the micro pedal because I have to fit it all on a small board to check on the plane. And if I had to put an overhead, I wanted to get a pedal board that could go, you know, that I could, it would be easy, in other words. So anyways, I dialed that in, and then there's another one. So the Wilmus is a good one. It's just the one that you can leave on. And it just gives it a little bit of richness, a little bit of kind of a like the brown sugar. But I kind of put them all on when I want just a ton of sound, and then I dial them back for more acoustic sounds. So it's like it's a push and pull between acoustic and electric, but it's subtle. I nothing is like – I don't hit a pedal and it's like, oh, there's a different sound in there.
Right.
I got another board for that when I'm just doing my electric rig, but I do so many gigs now, just, you know, solo.
Well,
and
funny. I when I started, I had huge boards, and then I went down to like a very small board, which is actually what I take to Summerfest. It's so small, I could put it in my carry-on.
Yes.
And just tuck it in, and it literally has three pedals. It's got an EB booster for my acoustic, and it's got a delay pedal. I think it's a Panther delay. And it's got, I switch the overdrive. So I'm like, I've got a lead tone. I can dial in the amp for a rhythm tone. And then I've got my acoustic set up. But, you know, I just built two more boards. I didn't think I was going to ever build another one. And then I found all these pedals that I started accumulating. And I found this one funky vibe. It's a Univibe, like a Henrik sound.
Oh, yeah. Those are awesome.
Dude, and that I was like, I'm building a Henrik board and I'm building a Prince influence board. So I built two boards, and they're so big, but I will use them for certain gigs and
for certain gigs.
Love them. But yeah, it's always, I know you, what I love about you is like, you think the way I think in the sense, what am I doing the gig for? And I want to make my life easier. So I want it to be small, and I want it to be jam packed with all the things I need, meat and potatoes. That's what I need.
As we get older, and we, you know, and I feel like it's funny, like for drummers out there, because we're sitting here nerding out on guitar stuff. But if any drummers are listening to this, I guarantee you, if like you're a new drummer and you just started and your first rig, you got like these huge racks. You probably got like a, you know, 50 piece kit, and then you start gigging, and like the most pro drummers, they've got like a kick, a snare, maybe a hi-hat. I'm just kidding. You know what I mean? The most pro drummers, they show up to the gig, and it's because you got to haul that shit around, you know?
Well, those are like, I know you've heard this joke. It's like when you see a drummer pulling out too many drums, you're like, I already know he can't play if he's playing.
Unless.
Don't put those up, you know?
Unless somebody else is pulling the drums out and setting him up for him.
That's
a different situation.
Yeah, that's definitely different. So let's go way back.
Yeah.
What was the moment of Zen that made you want to become a musician? What was it, a song? Was it a band? Was it family? What was the moment that you were like, I love music, I want to play music forever?
That's a good question. I think it hit me when I was like a pretty young kid. So my parents divorced when I was young, and so I was in California, and between California and Salt Lake City at the time. And I think growing up to that point, my mom and dad, when they were together, they sang a lot and played, they did gigs, you know, like more folk, kind of folk gigs, you know, kind of, you know, everything from like Bob Dylan to John Prine to, you know, Bonnie Raitt, that kind of vibe. And then when they split up, my dad had a record player, and he would be working, and I would put on vinyl records, and I didn't really know, you know, what they were, but I kind of figured out how to work the needle. And I would pull out pots and pans from the, you know, from the cupboard and make little drum sets and play along with it. That's kind of as far as back as I can remember.
That's awesome.
It was more of a way to pass the time, you know, but it obviously developed into a passion, because then when I got my hands on a guitar, I never let it down and ended up, you know.
How old were you when you picked up a guitar?
I think I was like around 5 or 6, but when I really started playing it and really, you know, going for it, I was like 10, I think, maybe 9 or 10. And then all through school, I was kind of a nerd, you know, total nerd, and it was a band geek, you know, and I ditched my lunch break to go into the practice rooms at school and play my guitar.
That's awesome, dude. And what were you playing? You're probably playing some hair metal. There had to have been some hair metal at that time.
No, I was always Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, Stevie Ray Vaughan from the beginning. And then I went to this high school jazz band, and that's why I was kind of, you know, it was really high school when I showed my true nerdy colors, because I was in there trying to figure out, you know, Joe Pass and all that. But it was cool because I went from in high school as like a total dork to I got into this band like in my senior year, first year of college. And it was a hip hop band, hip hop jazz band. All the guys in the band were older than me. And I just went from being like the total nerdiest kid to, you know.
Isn't that every rock star like known to man? That's how it is.
We opened up for the Black Eyed Peas during the 2002 awesome. Winter Olympics. And all of a sudden, all the girls that would never talk to me, all of a sudden they want to talk to me. I was like, what's that all about?
So you started taking it seriously. You wanted to go to – you went to New Orleans for school, right, to study jazz?
Yeah, after that. So I did one semester in Salt Lake City, and then I went to New Orleans, yeah. I ditched my senior prom. My dad is a super cool dude, and he took me to Jazz Fest, New Orleans Jazz Fest.
Awesome, dude. Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who, do you remember?
He's like, you could go to your senior prom, or we could go to Jazz Fest together. And I was like,
oh my God, that's so awesome. Who did you see?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. Really good question. I know that talking to you, Dave Matthews, I always think of Dave Matthews, but he was the big closer and he crushed it, you know.
Wow.
But who else did we see? There was a gospel tent, a jazz tent. I mean, there still is, but what I remember distinctly was the caliber of musicianship.
Yes.
Something, because growing up in Utah and even like Southern California, Orange County, I mean, I never really was exposed to that level of musicianship.
Right.
And everywhere you turn your head, people can play, like really can play. And I knew that if I wanted to take my playing to the next level, I had to go over to New Orleans, and I got my ass whipped out there. I'll tell you.
That's just a music city. I mean, it's in the water, you know?
Yeah.
So like, what was that transition like? I love these kind of stories, because it's like, this is where it actually accelerates your musical growth. When you get your ass kicked in a situation like that, that's what makes you work. So what was that
Absolutely.
Moment that you kind of like, you're in New Orleans, you're like, okay, I can play a little bit. And then what's that moment you're like, oh my God, these guys are unbelievable and I need to go home and just practice?
So in Utah, I got an award for like all-state jazz guitar or something. And I thought, oh, what, and I wasn't taking anything seriously. And I don't really think that award, I think the guy who was really good at reading didn't show up that day. So I got that award. I mean, it was a bullshit thing, but I still have this inflated sense of my ability. And then when I went to New Orleans, I literally feel like I was the worst musician in the entire
school.
I mean, it was just the biggest kick in the balls. It's like if you wanted to be a boxer, just sparring with Mike Tyson every day, you know?
Right, Right.
That's what it felt like, honestly.
And did you play like Frenchman Street, or did you
kind
of go all around all the venues and just cause
Frenchman, Bourbon. Yeah. And then I, you know, started forming bands with the kids that we met in you know, in New Orleans. I went to the University of New Orleans, so right there up on the lake. But that means we're 10 minutes from downtown.
Wow.
Met some world class. Well, Jonathan Batiste was one of my classmates.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's crushing it. Jeez. And then the late Mike Aiea, you know, what probably the best, I mean, he was by far the best sax player I've ever heard, you know.
And he had such a great year. We both know that. Like, that was one thing, like, I used to always tease him because I used to be like, no wonder you never learn parts, because you just hear somebody sing it to you and you play it right back. And it's like, that's always, like, such a great thing when a musician is freakish. That well-versed. Yeah, it's freakish. It's definitely – he had the best ear of any musician I've come across.
Yeah. He always made me feel uncomfortable playing with, because he always just teased me because he was so much better than me.
Well, you're the one that kind of bonded us together, man. You know, and it's like I remember going to one of our gigs in San Diego, and I drove him to the gig, and he was telling me all about you. He's like, "Oh man, you got to meet my buddy Ryan. He's a killer musician. He's a great guitar player. He can sing his ass off." And I'm like, "Dude, man, that's awesome." He's like, "Dude, I don't think you brought your guitar. I think I asked you to sit in." You're like, "Oh, I didn't bring my guitar, man." And I was like, "Well, shit."
Oh, that was at Longboards. Yeah, that was a TV at Longboards. Yeah, you know, right. That was one of the coolest. So San Diego back in those days, like it was a really cool town. Backing up to college at UNO, then Hurricane Katrina happened. I was on.
That's right.
Mike and I split up. You know, we kind of went our separate ways. He did his thing. I was on tour with a band off of Basin Street record label. Her name was Teresa Anderson, and we toured the country. And I had been to a few cities, and I was like, you know what, I need to go somewhere, because New Orleans was just toast. I mean, it was toast. Unless you had family there or a reason to stick it out, and I had no family there. So I was like, I can't hang around. I went from touring, being backstage and doing these incredible shows to literally washing dishes. Washing dishes it was horrible. You know, so I was like, okay, I'm going to finish my music degree. And then I got into a U-Haul, and I was like, what is the best city that I could have gone to? And I'm like, you know what? San Diego, when we played there, this is like 2004, 2005 maybe. It was just like off the charts. OB, Ocean Beach in San Diego. There were brass bands in the street. We played at Winston's. It was packed. I mean, it was like if you transplanted New Orleans to the water, you know, onto the sand. And I thought to myself, while I was there, one day I would like to live in San Diego. I didn't realize it would be so soon. But then I saw you several years later at Longboards. That was one of the best music venues, by the way, that you played at.
I love that venue, man.
Yeah, you crushed it.
It's not even there anymore. It's so sad, man.
I just remember, like, when you played, like, I mean, it's just packed full of people loving live music, dancing to your music.
Yeah, man.
And now you just walk up and down Garnett, and it's just, there's nothing, it's all gone. There's no, it's really sad. There's not a lot of live music like there was then in San Diego. I mean, I play it a lot, but now it caters mostly to like cocktail hour, you know.
I really respect this about you too. It's like, you're a hustler, man. It's like, you hustle gigs and play all the time. And it's like, I love that about you, because you're a player. It's like the real musicians. It's like, you know, the ones that are just like trying to get gigs, and the ones that are actually like doing it because they need it. They need it to breathe. They need it for their soul. They need it to just feel like they're doing something to practice on their instrument. And that's really essentially what gigs are. It's like you're practicing live, essentially. You know, it's like you're kind of formulating ideas and presenting something that you want to share with people. But it's really like, you know, this is what I love about music, but playing music is such a soulful experience, and it's something that we get to experience it in the moment. And I just love that you are always playing. You're always sitting in with people. You're always allowing people to sit in with you. It's just a real great thing about your spirit. And I hope you come to LA more, man. We got to have you.
Well, yeah.
We've got to do a show together.
But dude, I'm so glad you said that too, because just to elaborate on that, I feel like, you know, playing music is kind of like what we're doing now. I mean, I knew I was going to be on your show. We were going to share some stories and have a conversation. And when you're playing music, it's the same exact thing, especially from a jazz background. I mean, if you're from a jazz background, you're okay. Well, we're going to have an interview tonight. Let's talk about, you know, let's talk about your, how you started and maybe some of your favorite gigs. But we didn't go and write down each thing we were going to say. This is a improvisational conversation that we're having here. And that's what, and any musician that does it for a living, it's like, that's an opportunity to go up and express yourself. You're communicating. When you're playing music, you're communicating to other people, whether it be to your audience or your fellow musicians, you know? And I think that's why it is kind of like breathing, you know, because if you can't communicate, you can't, you know, you're suffocated there. So
I know you can relate to this too, because it's like all the work around the gig is actually the work. And when you're playing music, that's where it's like not work. You're just in the moment. You know, I've had shows where there's even maybe five people in the audience and I'm like exploring something. Maybe it's a new lick or a new way to solo over something, or I'm looping something. And I'm like having the time of my life, and it doesn't matter how many people are listening. And then there's shows where it's like, it's really big and there's tons of people, and you may not be getting that same kind of feedback back, because it's just too, it's like a wild, you know, kind of a wild ride, you know? So sometimes it's too much energy, like being swirled around where the sound's not dialed in and you're just trying to hang on for dear life. So it's funny that every gig is like this different kind of experience, but it's the actual playing that you really kind of like sink into. And that's the moment where you're like, this is the best job in the world. You know,
it's absolutely.
Like, I know you feel that too. So that
it's absolutely true. I mean, and we're so blessed to, you know, to be able to have those opportunities, I think.
When did you start making records, and what was the motivation and intent around making records and discovering your sound?
The first one I made, I was 18, I believe. And wow. I had written a bunch of songs, and this was back before, you know, the digital age and everything. And I found a great studio, and I went in with an acoustic guitar, and I just pounded out a record. Like,
wow.
And that was my first real kind of, you know, I did some overdubbing, and that really, I had some experience back in those days with the four track tape recorder. And then I went to music school. And if you listen to, so that it actually, a lot of people say that first record kind of sounded like Jack Johnson. It was like very acoustic, awesome, simple songs, you know, but catchy songs. And then I went to music school and I got all fucked up because it was all like, okay, you can't play a simple, you got to put some, you know,
some changes. 17,
some changes and some dissonance. And so my next EP called The Pure Project, I wrote most of the material in New Orleans, but I recorded it right when I moved to San Diego. And that is, if you listen to the two, you'd be like, this is a different artist.
Wow.
And then, but then I continued to kind of find my voice, because I realized I learned a lot coming to California and watching other artists and how important branding is. And you can't be the best, you know, like everything. Well, some people can, like Stevie Wonder or somebody. Right. You know? Like, he can play a reggae song and a jazz song. I mean, he can do everything. but like a lot of people now, especially now when you're competing against electronic and hip hop and all the other, like there's so much content, you kind of have to come out with some sort of a brand. So I feel like I finally got that on this last album. So I did one called How It Works with In Between the Pure Project up in Hollywood in Studio City with Andrew Williams, who was Andrew Williams' son, the singer.
Wow.
And actually Mike did a lot of work with him too, but he's a great producer. He worked with like Jessica Simpson, Five for Fighting, a lot of pop bands out there. And he taught me that you could make a record in your room. And that's what I learned. I mean, he was an amazing producer, amazing musician, songwriter, arranger, But I was so inspired with all that he had done with all these big artists in his tiny little room in Studio City, with a great preamp, a great set of studio monitors,
right,
some great plugins, and an ear. And he's doing, you know, platinum selling records. So I went home and I bought a Whisper Room. Have you checked out one of those?
Oh, what's that?
So if you go, if you ever go to the NAMM show, there's like these little boxes all throughout the NAMM show that are like these little, they're just soundproof rooms, but they're totally dead. So because I live in the city in San Diego and I want to record vocals and acoustic guitar, I bought one of those. I put it in my garage. And so
wait, it's like a little isolation. Like
that's what it is.
Okay. Yeah.
And I put my desk in an external monitor, and then a wireless keyboard inside of the Whisper Room. And then I got my LA 610 or whatever that is, the universal audio preamp. So yeah. I was running my guitar and my vocals through that. And I could do, so I did, my entire record with Pacific Records on pretty much in my garage.
That's crazy.
Yeah. The only thing I did with Pacific Records is record the drums in the big studio, but I did it after. So I created the drums in, what program did I use? Anyways, one of those drum programs. I created the beats online on my computer, and then I laid down bass, guitar, and did the whole map, went into the studio and cut the drums at the end, which I know is super weird.
No, but you know what? Like, that's how I do the songwriting team stuff. I'll do a drum loop and then I'll lay a bunch of stuff down and then I'll send it to a drummer and say, hey man, play a groove that I know is better than this.
Yep. Exactly.
They'll make it greasy and funky, and then you could just move stuff around to make it work. You know?
And actually, I did, once I said it to the drummer, then I came back and redid the bass line.
Oh, so, that's nice.
Yeah. And then I might have changed a couple of parts, but it was kind of like, I mean, traditionally you go and you lay down the rhythm section first. But for those of us without the, you know, that luxury to just go play around the studio, that's the way I did it. I'm really happy. I'm really proud of the last album, Big Medicine, because that's kind of the branding I was telling you about earlier. Oh, yeah. I finally kind of found that's kind of like my sound, you know.
Well, let's play something. What do you want to play first?
Let's see. Why don't we do Fast As We Can?
All right. Here's Ryan Hiller with Fast As We Can.
System. I believe in John's simple line, and I don't believe in fairy tales of the information coming all through the line. Well, I believe that people are all equal, 'cause I believe we all came from the same ground, and I don't believe in the hatred spewing from the mouths of all these clowns. We are all fast as we can. People, why do you do this to each other? Human nature is as wild as the way it sounds. And people, why do you justify, horrify, glorify, and frown? Well, people, why do you do this to your homeland? We're all stuck on the same rock until the day we die. We'll be right back.
fast as we can. Hey man, can we change the plan? We'll see the man fast as we can. Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Hey man, can we change the plan? Can we see the man fast as we can? Fast as we can.
Dude, that was so slamming, bro. The slamming.
Hey, man.
Love it. You got like a New Orleans thing, got like a little bit of a country Americana bluegrass thing.
Yeah.
Very jammy. It's awesome.
We just absorb what we, through our little lives. We take what we can from where we experience, and then that comes through the music. You know
what I love? It's like I'm an old fish head, and I love like how they incorporate some of those grooves.
But yeah,
like, you have sharper lyrics and a sharper melody and a better voice. So it's like taking some of those fish sounds and then swirling them in with some New Orleans sounds and some other more organic, like country Americana sounds. It's great.
I played the banjo on that song. I didn't even know I knew how to play the banjo.
Amazing. That's what that is right here. When I'm like tired of playing guitar, wait, where there, that's a banjo. I have to pull this out and just start fiddling around with it because it's just, man, it's just, you know this. It's like, you just want to explore more instruments. At first, it's like you want to just get good at one instrument. And then it's like as you get better at that instrument, you're like, I just want to play as many instruments as I can and be able to communicate and express on those instruments. So that's slamming, man. Who played piano on that? That guy was burning too.
His name's David Uter. He's an incredible musician, San Diego-based. Right. Yeah. Young kid and just this great, great keyboard player. Yeah.
It's great.
A lot of soul.
Your vocals, the lyrics, the song, the arrangement, the mix, everything was just banging. It was awesome.
Thank you so much, man. Awesome,
man. So
I loved your last album too, by the way. I've been on regular repeat.
Thanks, dude. So,
it's
so funny. We're about to play in like 3 weeks, and I'm like, I have to relearn my record. It's like, what? Dude. It's like I can't just like have all those lyrics like imprinted on my head. It's like, man, it's just not fair.
That is the weirdest. It's cool to hear another artist say that because sorry, the dishwasher's going on in the back. I am not in my normal element right now.
All good.
But honestly, like I'll go to a gig and I'll it's my own song and I'll forget the lyrics sometimes. And I'm like, you wrote this song.
Yeah.
How are you having this brain fart? But it's kind of cool hearing that other people.
I'm the worst. Man, I'm the worst. It's like
I heard John Legend has like a hologram of all his lyrics. Yeah, like he's got like a hologram like by his piano. So I haven't seen this, so it could be a rumor. Like, yeah, he's taken like a printout of his lyrics to the next level.
Well, you know what? I think it's like, sometimes I find myself, I'm rehearsing a lot or performing a lot, then the songs just become like in my DNA. But it's like since I haven't played this record, obviously with the pandemic, it's like some of these songs are old and I remember them, but some of them are new and I don't remember them. So like I've been trying to like just remember phrases and lyrics, hoping, and I'm like not there. So I'm like, I'm literally going to have to sit and practice my own song that I wrote. It's just weird, you know, because it's like once you write the song, it should just be forever embedded in you. But it's not how
you think so. And people are like, you know, some people who have listened to your song more than, you know, like listen to it. And then they're like, you're playing that. You're not playing that the way you wrote it. I'm like, I don't remember the way I wrote it.
Well, let's talk about that. What's your creative process? Do you start with lyrics? Do you start with a theme? Do you start with a groove? Do you start with an idea?
That's a good, man. You're asking great questions today. Man. I think normally I start with the guitar and usually it's some sort of melodic idea, you know, but sometimes that melodic idea is in the form of a rhythm. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Like a riff.
Sometimes I'll get the idea like for the rhythm of the melody and then I'll put the notes to it. Or sometimes I'll get the notes first, but it usually is the music first. And then the lyrics almost always come afterward. Same with you.
Yeah, same.
I had a song on Big Medicine. I didn't send you the track on there, but if people are watching or are interested, it's the first one on the record. It's called Soul Conversation. I had a dream that I was hanging out with Jimi Hendrix in a bar.
That's awesome.
And we're talking, and we're just talking about music. We're like, how do people write a good song? And while we're sitting there having a drink, there was a band playing outside the bar, like outside on a stage. And they were just playing like this awesome, like soulful Motown kind of groove. And he's like, that's all you do. Just do that. And they were playing that song, Soul Conversation. It was in a dream. And I woke up and I like just went and I used my voice memo on my cell phone. I got a bunch of ideas on there. And I just was like, I woke up in a dream and it sounded like I was on drugs. I was just like, kind of. But the next morning when I actually woke up, I went and it all made sense. It like came back to me. And wow. So that song came to me in a dream, like full on. So
you know, I had one experience like that with a Bob Marley. It was like Bob Marley showing me a song. And it's like, I wrote a song like that. And
that's so cool.
You know, what's cool about that? Like I've not heard a lot of songwriters say, I've heard Santana say it. I've heard Paul McCartney say it, but not many others. So I have talked to other songwriters about it. And, you know, I talked to this one reggae guy who's he's a big songwriter and he was friends with Bob Marley. And I was telling him about this experience and he's like, so you've been to the righteous place. And I was like, that is the perfect way to sum that up. Because dude, you sitting in a dream with Jimi Hendrix, him showing you a song, whatever that place is, that is the righteous place, man. That you
absolutely
bridge the gap right there. So next time I'm going to have to hear that song because dude, now I'm super curious. You're going to have to send that to me anyways. Well, let's put something
I'll send
else.
It to you anyways. I'll send you the whole CD.
Please, man. Yeah. What do you want to play us next?
So so you actually helped me with this one. I was doing a track and this is the last song I've done actually, because I got so, you know, sideswiped with COVID and everything. I haven't released anything since this single, but it's called Happiness. Oh, and yeah. It's a song that I did. And I did everything again at my home studio that you're hearing, except for the drums. And so played all the instruments, everything. And I brought in my buddy Johnny Tarr on sax. And I had it all done. I realized, you know, I can get the sounds in, but to really be good at mixing and mastering, that's dude, to have someone who knows what they're doing. And you put me in touch with these guys.
Was it Daryl Thorpe?
Yep, Daryl Thorpe. And then Joe Bosa. Yep, those guys crushed. So dude, you'll hear a difference. We'll do. Big Medicine was, you know, Pacific Records local company or local record company in San Diego. Now we're going to go LA. You're going to hear a little difference in production. And then on the last song, we'll end with, I'll explain that song. But yeah, so this one's called Happiness.
Awesome. Here's Happiness with Brian Hill. Waka!
When you see me going down,
Making the funky face the whole time, dude, so funky, very Sly Stone influenced, man, just funky,
cool. Thanks, man.
Got some Cool in the Gang vibes, all the good things about funk. I remember when you sent me that track, when you finished it, I was like, god damn, this is burning. I mean, it's a
thank you track.
It is,
it means a lot coming from me, brother. Thank you so much,
that
man.
Solo, that guitar solo, ridiculous, dude.
Don't you have one of the Sly and the Family Stones musicians in your band?
Jesse Stern used to play with Sly. He used to say those gigs were crazy. He would just like, he would come out super late to gigs, and then like he would call songs that weren't on the set list like all the time.
That's so awesome.
Everybody was just like always had their shit together, and he said he was just like always hanging for dear life just to like make sure, because he was such a loose cannon. But he said he was ultra creative in that way, because
yeah,
always like wanting to do things. But I was at Coachella and he didn't even show up for the gig. I was like,
what's that?
He's like, yeah, he does that a lot, you know. So like sometimes he's just not motivated to play, or he's in his hotel room doing whatnot, you know. But
yeah,
his influence is far and wide, and you can hear it on that track, man.
Thank you.
How many takes did you do that guitar solo before you were like, okay, that's the one?
I think six.
That's amazing.
Five or six of them. Yeah.
Did you find yourself like you were like trying to find this balance of phrasing or like,
you know what I do? And I'm a really shitty golfer, but here's the analogy. I suck, but I'm starting to enjoy it as I'm getting older. And the harder I try, the worse I do. Like the harder I try to hit the ball, it goes in the woods, or it goes 4 feet in front of me. And that's the same thing as a guitar solo. The more notes I play and the harder I try to impress people, the more I try to say, the less comes out of, you know, the less I actually end up getting across.
Right.
And I think it when you hit a great golf swing, and I suck, I'm terrible. But for me, it's like when I just don't think and I just relax, it comes out. And that's what happens with a good guitar solo. It's a balance of phrasing. You got to throw a little bit of, you know, energy in there, but it doesn't have to be like when I was a kid, it was all like Van Halen, you know, as many notes as you can fit into a small space.
But I still do that. Every guitar solo that I track, the first three takes, it's always like, I literally joke with every engineer. I'm like, all right, you have to give me three takes to just bullshit to get out all the bad notes, you know, like, yeah. I'll play a bunch of like choppy shit that I would never, and I'm like disgusted with myself. And then after take three, I'm like, all right, now let's make some music. All right, now let me try and do something a little bit more soulful. But it's just like, I have to get those three takes out just because I'm like, I'm indulgent on all the levels. I'm like, let me play the craziest thing I can play just to see if it's going to sound good. It never sounds good, dude. So
it's fun so much.
Yes.
Hey, look, it's so fun. Yes. It's fun to play as fast as you can, but for the listener, you know, yes, especially a non-musician listener, they'd rather hear something that is musical and makes sense and is grooving and is in really good time than something just totally outlandishly ridiculous.
I know you're like this too, because I'm like this. It's like, I always listen to a slow guitar solo, like a Stevie Ray Vaughan Pride and Joy, where he's just like bending for like three beats. And it just, those are the riffs that kill me the most.
But yeah.
Hear him let loose.
Yeah.
Like, goddamn. It's like, how is that person thinking?
Like a solo on Little Wing. Stevie Ray Vaughan's Little Wing. It's just
best.
Like,
it's the best.
What does he do? Like 12 passes through it? It's just,
yeah, it's unmoving.
Each one builds energy. I mean, How can you have that much to say? I mean, it's incredible.
Yes.
Yeah.
I struggle with those all the time, and it's amazing you did that in six takes. That would have taken me probably three times as many takes until I liked the solo. So that's awesome that you were like, you were fluid and able to just play something you liked so quick. That's
Thank you, brother.
That's a testament to your work. And how did you do the horn arrangements and all of that?
The horn arrangements, so Johnny was in there. He's also singing the high part on there. So I'm a baritone, and he's like a badass tenor. I think he's living in the UK now, but he's a great local musician in San Diego too, Johnny Tarr. And he's got a great records out, like more disco funk kind of stuff.
Awesome.
But yeah, so I thought it would be a good collaboration, and I wasn't prepared with written out charts, but in my head I kind of knew. So I just played, I just kind of played it to him on my guitar in the studio. I said, here, can you do this? And then a couple of them I just sang, but I knew what I wanted in my head. And then I was also editing. So I would like edit some things and play it back and be like this, but more like this. And I played it on the guitar. So it happened very quickly. It wasn't like a big, long process. It was, and it's a pretty simple horn arrangement, but I wanted something that was just kind of, like you said, like cool in the gang, you know, something just fun and, you know, like driving, you know, I wanted like a driving.
Well, you got it. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. It's like, you know, it sounds like it's this 10 piece horn section. And everybody's just
one horn.
I know, that's what's so crazy. And it just sounds slamming. It's just a great, great arrangement, great song, great style.
Thanks, brother.
Five stars, man. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Let's play something else. What are we going to play next?
All right. This last tune, I wrote this one. I was hiking up to Mount Whitney. So highest peak in the continental United States. And my wife and I had no idea like what we were doing. So we went up there with a couple backpacks, and I like brought a pair of jeans with me. I mean, why? I don't know. I packed the most ridiculous shit. Like, we had no clue what we were doing. We set up a tent, and it went from like 80 degrees to that night. I think it was like 40 degrees. Oh, so we almost froze to death. Because we slept on the mountain up at like 11,000 feet. And we're just holding each other as tight as we can for body warmth. And then I could have sworn a bear was like walking around going, like I could hear some animal, just like it would sound like a big animal breathing in and out. And all I had was like this little knife. I'm just sitting there like this. She's crying hysterically on my shoulder. I'm like, we're going to die. We're either going to freeze to death or we're going to die. There's nowhere we can go. There's nobody who we can call. We're all alone. So we wake up the next morning and we decide to go the rest of the way. So we hike up to the top of Mount Whitney. She gets sick, altitude sickness. I mean, and then we get back to our tent. We had to go so slow because I thought I was going to have to carry her. We pack up our tent. We get all our shit. Now it's dark. We had to hike from 11,000 feet all the way back to our car in the pitch black with no headlamps.
What?
Yeah. So I'm walking down the mountain and I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, how stupid are we? Number one. Number two, we're doing everything we can just to survive this ordeal. We ran out of food. We had no water. Like, we were just total idiots. Like, no preparation.
So you're the people that the news talks about, basically.
Exactly. Just, oh, well, let's hike Mount Whitney. I know how to hike. I'm from Utah. Like,
two hikers disappeared. Yeah. Yeah. That's you and your wife right there. It could have been.
I give her so much credit because she didn't complain once, and she did it. She did the whole thing.
Wow.
But so anyway, so we're in the dark, and I'm like, we're definitely – there's all these signs for bears. And I could have sworn there was a bear next to our tent. So I'm just thinking about – getting eaten alive by a bear. Maybe I just saw Revenant, you know? Anyway, so the song you're about to hear, the inspiration, the tune, the song came to me as I'm walking 6 hours in the pitch black with a tiny little, you know, pocket knife. It's called Gotta Survive.
Here's Gotta Survive with Ryan Hill.
And you gotta survive. And then you gotta survive. Facing sights unseen. Well, who can you trust? This is all just a dream. Strange people, can you let them in? When you're stranded in the middle of a sea full of hate. Towering up above, cutting through the cutter, I'll reach you for an ounce of love. Well, as you reach here, the weight's putting you down. Cause you're running through the dark and you're a long, long way from town, yeah. And I'm feeling quite alive for the first time. And then you gotta survive. And then you gotta survive. Huh.
and that you gotta survive. And that you gotta survive.
I was slamming, man. What a great story, too. What a crazy story.
Thanks.
Remind me never to go hiking with you ever, dude.
It gives a little context. Yeah, don't let me perfect. Plan to hike. Dude, I can move my legs back and forth, but other than that.
Ryan, you really are one of the most tremendous artists, and I really mean that.
Thank you, man.
You
too.
Writing songs. I hope you always keep making records. You and I need to collaborate on some music, and we need to definitely collaborate on some shows. Real quick, where can people find you if they want to find your music and buy your records?
Just my website's great, ryanhillermusic.com.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
So just like it says on the screen, ryanhiller music, music.com.
All right. Well, we're going to have to have you back in 9 or 10 months. And we wish you all the best. And we know you have a new arrival coming soon.
Yeah. So yeah.
But love and light, man. And dude, let's collaborate when you get back. When are you back in town?
I'll be back in San Diego on the 23rd. So
maybe the 24th or 25th, we're going to have to start writing some music together. You and me.
I'm in.
Let's do it.
I'm in. Let's jam, dude. We got to do it. We've been saying it too long.
Yeah. When you come back from San Diego, send me a text. Say, I'm back in town. And I've got it on tape now. We're going to do this, all right?
You are the witnesses out there.
That's right.
Digital land.
Happy travels, Ryan. On behalf of Sam and myself and Ryan Hiller, thank you guys very much. Check out his music, ryanhillermusic.com. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you, Ryan. Take care.
Thank you.
And be safe, all right?
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.